Anyways, we've got Bill Still with us this evening, and he is has made several films, and one of them is The Money Masters and The Secret of Oz. And Eric, would you like to introduce our guest then?
Well, yeah, as you say, William T. Still is the guy who put together a rather influential film called The Money Masters, and most recently another film called The Secret of Oz, which has to do with our financial woes. And then he's also written a book in 1990 called The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies. So he has a sweep of a vision and perspective which goes way back, and I think we can hopefully tap into some of that as we try to shed light on our financial crisis now. Bill, I watched The Secret of Oz recently, and maybe we could start there. In that movie, you start you talk about, of course, The Wizard of Oz, which was written about 1900 by L. Frank Baum, and you talk about that movie as kind of a parable for monetary reform, which is not well known to most people, although almost everybody knows the story of The Wizard of Oz. Very few know the symbolism that is revealed in the movie that you talk about. In fact, just to kind of give people a background, the one important difference between the movie and the book is that in the book, Dorothy has silver slippers, which she can click, she learns later, at any time, and that has to do with monetary reform and monetizing silver, which was a very big political issue back around the turn of the last century, and William Jennings Bryan ran on that platform for the Democratic Party. And maybe you could you start off and tell us just a little bit about that movie and how you think that is very pertinent to our situation today?
Well, the silver slippers were all about was increasing the money supply to break the back of the post-Civil War depression, which was far worse than the depression of the 1930s. In the 1930s, I believe, according to Milton Friedman, the amount of money in circulation was reduced by one-third, 33%. During the post-Civil War depression, which lasted for 30 years, the amount of money in circulation was reduced by 84%. Just to compare to what's happened in today's world is due to the contraction that began in 2008, the world money supply has been reduced by at least 40%. So although this is going to take a while to spiral downwards, what economists call deleveraging the economy, you can clearly see what's coming ahead. It's going to be something at least as deep as the Great Depression of the 1930s, and it might yet devolve into something even worse.
Well, before we get into this situation, which I think is, of course, everybody is very interested in finding out new perspectives on how this economic crisis or credit crisis has occurred. Let me just kind of talk about the symbolism in The Secret of Oz, which I think most people are perhaps not aware of, which is that the Wicked Witch of the East and the West were thought to represent respectively J.P. Morgan, the banker, and John D. Rockefeller. And the farmer was more or less thought to represent the scarecrow was thought to represent the farmer who, you know, kind of people thought he was kind of a bumpkin and kind of slow-witted, but in fact he understood things pretty well. The Tin Man was a representative of the industrial workers who had lost their heart by becoming cogs in the machine. The Cowardly Lion was supposedly representing the politician, William Jennings Bryan, who championed this populist movement to reform the monetary system, but then backed off, much like a coward might. And the gold road, the yellow brick road to Emerald City, was indeed somewhat having to do with the gold standard and a trek by a bunch of farmers to Washington D.C. Back in the late 1800s to try to get some financial justice. Does that kind of talk about the symbolism? Can you expand a little bit on that?
Boy, I couldn't have said it more succinctly myself. The yellow brick road was indicative of the gold standard, and it too was different in the book version than in the movie version. In the book version, the yellow brick road was fraught with danger, and it was only because Dorothy was wearing the silver slippers were they able to negotiate it safely. And so although the silver slippers being changed to ruby slippers were the major difference between the film and the book, certainly the yellow brick road was not a smooth yellow brick road as shown in the movie. It was fraught with danger, as was Baum's idea of the gold standard back in their days.
Yeah, and one of those dangers, just one of them, was the falling asleep in the field of poppies, which has to do with the opium wars with China, I believe, as at least interpreted in the movie. And, of course, the opium wars with China was the way that the British Empire and also, to some extent, certain American interests were able to steal enormous amounts of money from China by addicting their population to opium. And so falling asleep in the poppies was one of the symbols, I think, as well as... The monkeys and all kinds of like you say, hazards along the way to Emerald City or Washington, D.C. to see the wizard who was the president, I guess.
Falling asleep in the poppies was the populist movement did not want their champion, William Jennings Bryan, to fall asleep by getting diverted into this opium war thing. They wanted him to continue to champion what they believed, and certainly I believe, is the most important issue of their era and ultimately ours, and that is that the United States needs to take back the money power, which in my belief is the most important power of a sovereign nation. Take it away from the private bankers who have it today and had it back in Bryan's day. Recapture what they call monetary sovereignty for the nation once again. That's the major problem that's going on right now is we don't control the quantity of money. Unelectable bankers control it right now, and that quantity of money got out of control. They created way too much of it, boosted up housing prices beyond anybody's ability to pay. And then everybody came right along behind, if you remember, and refinanced their houses up to the maximum extent. And so when those housing prices turned south, then everybody became illiquid and ultimately bankrupt. And that's what our problem is today.
And the kind of the powers that be in terms of manipulating the economy today, are they pretty much the same? Is it pretty much the same dynamic as we've seen over the last 140 years?
It's pretty much the same dynamic that's been going on for the last 400 years. And that is that they create too much money. They benefit from that money creation because they're creating it as debt, and they are the recipients of the interest on that debt. And then as soon as the debt gets more than the society can sustain, when the economy crashes, then, of course, the holders of that debt, the bankers, also have those debts collateralized, and they get to foreclose on a significant portion of people's equity, and namely, which always primarily is the real estate. And so they get to buy that real estate for pennies on the dollar, knowing full good and well that eventually they'll be able to start refloating the balloon, and they'll be able to make out handsomely, because these bankers see things not from checkbook, paycheck to paycheck like most of us do. They see things in very long-range terms, in years or decades.
Bill, what's interesting about your movie The Money Masters is that it really does kind of start back at the beginning of the inception of this country and gets into the whole history of the monetary system here. And that, to me, was, I mean, and it's very, very thorough in how you go about presenting it.
Well, The Money Masters was good for its day, but it was filmed in 1995. This was before the dawn even of digital video, so it was filmed in an old video format called High 8. So it was getting pretty long in the tooth, and I was always looking for a way to tell the story in a shorter amount of time, because The Money Masters is 3 hours and 23 minutes, and although, you know, a certain amount of people will sit through something like that, it certainly doesn't make it very accessible to the large majority of the population, which we are going to need behind monetary reform in order to make it politically viable. So I was always looking for a way to tell the story more succinctly, and when I heard about the Wizard of Oz connection, I jumped on it immediately and started filming The Secret of Oz. It's the same story, represents 15 years down the road, evolvement in my thinking on the problem, and is told in less than half the time.
Well, let me ask you, Bill, about The Money Masters. I having gone through the public school system, this movie came as a shock to me. It's really a reinterpretation of American history into economic terms, which makes perfect sense, of course. But it's new information, and I must say I've probably watched it 8 or 10 times and learned each time. As I recall, you were basing a lot of the film on the work that was done by a collaborator. Can you tell us a little bit about that collaborator and where that collaborator dug up a lot of the information?
That collaborator dug up almost all the information from me. I wrote a book in 1993 called, the name has escaped me for the moment. I'm supposed to know the names of my own books. On the Horns of the Beast, the Federal Reserve, and the New World Order.
Okay.
And this guy called up and said, boy, this is great. What can we do next? And I said, let's make a video. And so he said, okay, let's go. And so 90% of the material I wrote in the book.
So would it be fair to say that then you make your living as an author and as a producer of films? Or have you got other irons in the fire, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. I've been a professional writer since 1977.
Okay, and the book is On the Horns of the Beast, and what's the subtitle there?
The Federal Reserve and the New World Order.
Okay, so the story that you tell about the Federal Reserve in that book, I suppose, is fairly similar to the story told by Eustace Mullins in his book and Anthony C. Sutton in his book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and B. Edward Griffin, and et cetera, which is the story about how a very small cabal of international bankers managed to get a bill passed in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act, which allowed this small group of international bankers to control the printing of the currency and to do it so they could essentially create money out of nothing and charge interest on it.
Well, not at all. I take great issue with Griffin in that although he does good historical work, when he starts delving into the conclusions and what should be done, he just follows the standard line, which most guys, in fact, just about everybody has followed since the turn of the century, and that is that a return to a gold-backed money is the answer to our problems. And, of course, that's, if you've seen The Secret of Oz, you see that that is the major thrust in the movie, that this gold-backed currency has been tried time and time throughout American history. It never favors freedom. It never favors the middle class. It always favors the bankers and rule by bankers, which is what we have today. So, no, I differ with Griffin and Eustace Mullins and all those guys, Sutton, because basically their solution is a return to gold-backed money.
Well, one of the things that I have to agree with you on with your assumption is because the same people that control the gold control the other. So it would seem it would make reason that going along your lines.
Well, I mean, you can theorize all you want, but especially in economics, nothing beats a track record. And certainly this go-back money thing, if you look at monetary history, has been tried time and time again, and it doesn't work. And if you look back even beyond the United States, there is never a single society throughout history where gold-back money has served the interests of the middle class, has served to democratize power. It always serves to centralize power into the hands of the wealthiest citizens. And, of course, that's the classic battle of humanity throughout the sweep of world history, and that is an escape from serfdom. What is serfdom? Serfdom is the wealthiest folks having all the power and making the rest of us essentially serfs. And that is the core message of the foundation of the United States. And that message is still spreading out throughout the world. That's why people come to America still today. They have heard this message repeated for generations by their fathers and grandfathers, that, you know, America was the place where we finally gained freedom, where we finally escaped serfdom. And that's still going on today, despite the fact that, you know, we're starting to lose that at a very quick rate, I think. Still, America is the freest country in the history of the world.
Do you have many people backing your assumption then that of and conclusion in the monetary system where it doesn't have to be gold-backed?
Well, it's certainly gaining popularity today, but when I started out, I wrote my first professional article on this in 1980, and, you know, I was the only one out there. I would go to conferences throughout the 90s, and I was the only one. I'd stand up there in front of people and tell them that gold was not the answer, and you'd hear gasps throughout the audience, you know, that I was speaking sacrilege. So finally it's starting to catch on, and I think when people look at the history, it's just pretty much irrefutable. We've been there. We tried it. It didn't work.
Yeah. I must say that, you know, I actually showed your movie Secret of Oz to one of my classes in human ecology towards the end of the class, and I think most of the class was quite interested and impressed. There were, however, one or two people with a traditional background in economics who were most disgruntled, and they really got fired up and really tried to defend the Federal Reserve as being absolutely essential to the workings of our country. Do you suppose then that most of our universities do a pretty good job of what should we say, indoctrinating our students? That what we have is the best system?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my brother-in-law is an economist. I don't want to give away where exactly, but let's say at a major university in the Midwest, professor of economics. And the way he puts it is that mainstream economists today cannot imagine a world outside of the Federal Reserve. That's everything they're taught. That's everything they know. And, you know, this is a deliberate contrivance because the bankers essentially bought up economic academia years ago. They learned to control the message years ago, and they've controlled it very well. There have been a few breakouts, like Milton Friedman, with whom I actually had personal telephone conversations during the editing process of The Money Masters. He assisted to a certain degree, and I'll never forget. I tell this story, which lots of people find interesting. During the editing of the first cut of The Money Masters, I decided, you know, I better find myself a professor of economics somewhere. And I'd been a professional writer for years, so I knew how to do this. You know, you just call the university press office and say, I need to talk to a professor of economics. I've got a documentary here on the economy, and I need some comment. And they say, yeah, well, anybody in particular? And I say, yeah. I was talking to Stanford University. I said, yeah, how about Milton Friedman? No problem. Next day, ring, ring, Milton Friedman calls on the phone. So I told him what I wanted. He said, yeah, here's the address. Send it on out here, and I'll take a look at it. A couple days after it arrived, ring, ring. It's Milton Friedman on the phone. I'll never forget the first words out of his mouth. He goes, he was a kind of a gruff, grumpy old guy by then. He goes, boy, if you kill the Fed and don't do anything about fractional reserve lending, you've done nothing. And then he went on and on. And, you know, he was very helpful. And that really rocked my world. I had not really... I was still in the evolutionary step of thinking if we just killed the Fed, that would solve all our problems. And that's because I really didn't understand what the base of the problem was. The root of the problem is not the Fed. The Fed is just the shell, the front man for the real power. And the real power are the largest commercial banks who create the vast majority of the money, so that's what we have to get to. It's not what backs the money that's important. It's who controls its quantity. And right now, these large commercial banks, with their derivative plays and all that, just blew up the money balloon to titanic proportions. The size of which we probably don't even know today yet, and probably won't know for another 10 years how big it got. But we do know one thing for certain, and that's it is crashing. And all of this, here Obama has pumped in $3 trillion of economic stimulus, and it still won't stop it. So that's how bad it is. And if you look at the macro numbers, you can see why. The total wealth of the United States is around $50 trillion in rough terms. Okay, so if we saw a 40% initial depreciation in the wealth of the U.S., that would be $20 trillion. So Obama's $3 trillion kind of pales in comparison. It would take a lot more, and yet there's not a lot more to give. So that was just a temporary Band-Aid, and now... from this point forward, we're going to start to see the spiral accelerate in a downward trajectory that's going to bring a lot of hardship to the United States. The good news is that we can fix this problem in very short order, a year or two at most. We can definitely make a dent in the problem in a matter of months simply by instituting a debt-free monetary system.
Is there anybody in power in Congress or in Washington who is taking up this ball and running with it at all, discussing this kind of thing?
No, still, since the bankers have all the power, have all the money, still have the money creation power, I mean, you've seen what the reaction has been in the Obama administration, for example. This financial reform bill, who is it approved by? All the biggest banks think it's just great. Well, that's not my idea of reform. We're going to have to, that the pain is going to have to get more intense before people truly start clamoring for an answer. There will be a cadre, and that's what I'm trying to do. Start to create a cadre of people across the country who actually know what the correct solution will be. Because when the bad times really start to happen, the Ron Paul people with their gold-backed money solution are going to be there, and they've got 100 times more people than our team does. And so we just have to, that's going to bring nothing but the same disaster that we had during the 1896 presidential election, and time again before that. So I'm just trying to build a little bit of knowledge base amongst at least a few people across the country and really across the world, because we're having significant success in Sweden and Iceland as well.
Well, now, before we get into these solutions that you have in mind, could you just connect the dots a little bit between our own Federal Reserve banking system and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the major international lending agencies? How do they differ in their approach and in their identity, actually, and in their consequences to the central banks of the individual nations?
Well, you know, I'm afraid that that's kind of a question that I can't answer very well. I'm sure because of the way you framed it, you have a better handle on that particular question than I do. So I'd turn it around back to you, because I really don't have a good answer to that. So what's your response to some question?
Well, okay. Well, my and actually, you do discuss this in your Money Masters movie to some extent. You talk about the, you know, the trend towards regionalizing the globe in terms of trading blocks, et cetera. You talk about the World Trade Organization as, I think you do, as the beginning of kind of an international government based on trade relationships. As I understand it, the Federal Reserve and U.S. banks make up, say, the at least the largest component of the International Monetary Fund, which in concert with the World Bank, these are institutions that came out of the Bretton Woods agreements back in New Hampshire in 1944, right after World War II, and basically set the rules for international trade. And what happens is that the World Bank loans money to third world countries, but it does so at exorbitant interest rates, and then the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, comes in as a debt cop and says, okay, you can't pay your debt, and they cleverly and get them ensnared in debt, and then they say, well, if you want us to float another loan to you, you're going to have to restructure your economy with structural adjustment programs, which are pretty much the same, and most of the world's approximately 190 countries are under the thumb of these structural adjustment programs now, and increasingly the United States is as well, and this has to do with selling off your publicly owned assets, you know, like phone systems and water systems and national parks and things like that, and privatize them, sell them off pennies on the dollar. And of course, that means that they can't spend their national money on social programs like education and health care and things like that. That money has to go to pay off the debt. So what you have is a kind of a debt strangulation system to third world countries, which has been very effective in maintaining, shall we say, neo-colonial relations with the former colonies of the European countries, so that these countries were never able to develop and become self-sufficient economically, even though they might be very resource-rich, places like Argentina and Indonesia, et cetera. There are many, many countries, Venezuela, which should be very rich, but because of the imposed draconian structural adjustment programs the IMF has imposed, they've never been able to get out of debt. And this is what I see now happening to the United States. These very same techniques are now applied here, because of course we're a debtor nation now, what, $9 or $10 trillion or more. And of course, if you are a creditor and you can now dictate terms to the borrower, this is happening in California where I teach. You know, we're whatever $20 billion in debt, so they have to cut welfare, they have to cut education, all as a way to, quote, balance the budget, but really it's a political agenda that's being advanced, and that, of course, is to break the middle class. Like you say, bring us back to a feudalistic serf-type society. Go ahead, yeah.
The American middle class is the richest middle class that's ever existed in the history of the world, and that money is going to be sucked out of it. And right now they don't really see it, but come the first of the year when those tax increases start to hit, they're going to really start to feel the pinch. In Iceland, for example, I mean, you're exactly right. I couldn't have said that better myself. In Iceland, for example, when I was there recently, I learned that the structure that the IMF set up, the austerity program they set up, would have resulted in Iceland having to pay 100% of its GDP just paying the interest on loans. Well, of course, that's an impossible situation, and so that's why the people of Iceland have revolted, and I think we have a really excellent chance of developing a proper monetary system there in Iceland. Of course, this when money is sucked out of the system, as you explained so well, then it's not available for enriching society. What does enriching society mean? It means empowering and enriching the middle class. The average person has money. They don't become serfs. They don't become feudal slaves. They have a little more money than living absolutely paycheck to paycheck, week to week. They have some savings. They have the ability to invest small amounts of capital and create businesses for themselves. Well, all that's going to go away, trust me. So you talk about neocolonialism. Well, all you're really saying is a return to feudalism and serfdom. And you see now that Obama has changed his rhetoric direction from economic revival to austerity. And that's exactly because the IMF has stepped in and proclaimed to the United States and all the European nations, you know, you need increasing austerity programs. In other words, slash your social programs so you can pay the interest on our debt.
Yeah, just for the benefit of our audience, and I do plan to let my students know that this interview is available. The kind of austerity programs that we're talking about that the IMF has imposed in third world countries over the years have had a number of terms such as neoliberalism or neoliberal reforms or the Washington Consensus or the Golden Straitjacket. But basically, this group of international bankers has been able to control the economies of third world countries and siphon that money out of those countries and put them into debt bondage such that, well, those of us who've traveled around the world, you know, or even those of us who read, know that, you know, about half the world, according to the UN statistics, lives on less than the equivalent of $2 a day, and that about one-fifth of the world's population lives on the equivalent of less than $1 a day. This is not because those people are, you know, stupider than us. It's because they live in an economic system which does not allow them to get an education, to advance themselves, to form. What you have in most third world countries is a feudal system with a very few people at the top who are extremely rich, and everybody else is in that lower slave serf class. And this is the way of most of the world's history, and indeed most of the world today. And as you say, in America, we have broken free of that to an unprecedented extent. And most of us who are listening to this and who are talking here have enjoyed a brief period in human history where we've lived very well compared to historical standards.
This has been a golden bubble just maybe for the last two or three generations, that our children, unfortunately, my kids as well, they just don't believe that it's going to collapse, it's going to fall apart. They sincerely believe things are going to go along and they're going to get to play their video games for the rest of their lives. Raw! You know, the one thing to try to simplify matters, to help people not feel like they can't comprehend this, is that what nations need to do, what the United States needs to do, is outlaw national debt. If we would just do that one thing, it would solve so many problems. No more national debt. It is doable. We can do it, and it fixes to a remarkable degree our problems. You talk about the serfdom that's going on internationally. Well, you know, it's even worse than serfdom. According to the United Nations' own figures, millions of people die every year for lack of just a few millions of dollars in basic medical care. You know, so that's why I say in the film, this is the leading cause of most of the world's hunger, poverty, misery, disease, and death. And, you know, it's just absolutely immoral. Young people, if you are listening to this program today, this is the new human rights of your generation. Jump on the bandwagon. We can fix this. It is the most egregious societal ill ever in the history of humanity, and that's not an exaggeration.
Okay, great. Well, now I think we've set the stage, Bill. Could you kind of give us your idea of how we can solve this problem as a country, and then hopefully be the prototype for solutions for other countries, or perhaps we can learn from the states, like you point out in your movie, and use them as an example, like North Dakota, or how should we proceed?
Well, there's basically two different levels to this solution in the United States. Personally, I think our best shot is to get behind Iceland right now, because it is a sovereign nation. Its people are used to freedom, and suddenly they see that that's gone. There's been a radical transformation. The people are mad. They voted for a joke party as the mayor of the capital city of Iceland, Reykjavik, which incidentally has two-thirds of the population of the entire nation. And it just started out as a joke two weeks before the election. The leading comedian said things like, I will never keep any campaign promises that I make, stuff like that. And he won the largest percentage of the vote, so suddenly he became mayor of the capital city. And, we're talking to these people seriously, and they're taking it seriously. There was a meeting just tonight, the results of which I've not heard. I think once we get our foot in the door in Iceland, then, for example, I was in Sweden a couple of months ago, and had I been able, and met with a Swedish parliamentarian there, and had I been able to point to Iceland and say, you see, this is what they're doing in Iceland, that's why it's working, then he would have paid a little more attention. Whereas it was, remarkably, and this was the Green Party's in Sweden, their leading finance guy, and when he finally understood what we were talking about, he turned to me and said, if I did this, I'd be committing political suicide. So he understands the forces at play, and unless you have a significant outburst from the population, a political outburst, these politicians just don't have the guts to try to implement such a thing. I know the president of Iceland was just waiting. He hated the idea of giving into these IMF austerity measures, and he was just waiting for a large enough outburst from the Icelandic population to get significant press attention so that he could veto the measure that their parliament passed going along with the IMF. And so now the ball is really rolling, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and we have a significant opportunity in Iceland. Now, to go on to the United States, there are basically two levels of solution, and they're significantly different in some ways, but at the core, it's the same concept. The federal solution and the state solution. We'll start with the state solution because I think, once again, I'm very practical, politically speaking, and I think this is how we have our best chance here. And that's to follow the Bank of North Dakota model. It still would be using the fractional reserve principle, but it would be using international banking rules against them to empower states and expand state sovereignty in an atmosphere where state sovereignty is quickly eroding. And if you approach your local state politician on this basis that he can enhance state sovereignty, his ears perk up right away, because that's what they want to hear. They know that's what their constituents want to hear. Even veteran politicians are just mad as heck that the federal government is pushing them around, telling them what to do. And, states are supposed to have a certain level of sovereignty within the United States. And that's always been the case, even though unless you really work in state-level politics, you don't really realize how important that is, and certainly not how important it is to your average state politician. So if you push it from that direction, they pay attention. The Bank of North Dakota essentially removes the necessity for state governments to borrow because they can borrow from their own state bank. There are two ways to charter a bank in the United States. This has traditionally always been true. You can charter it federally through the only way most people know about, the federal way, where you have federal deposit insurance and all that sort of thing, and you go through the Federal Reserve. But there's another way, and that's in harmony with the state sovereignty concept, and that's you can have a state charter where basically your state legislature can just say, okay, we're giving a state bank charter to this guy over here. You can start business, and they make their own rules on what that has to look like and all that. But, you know, in North Dakota, what they did was back in 1919, I believe, they created a state bank for the exclusive use of the state. So by law, all state tax receipts and all the state's infrastructure goes in to the state bank. Well, and so then what you can do, according to international banking rules, at this point, you only need an 8% reserve. So you can multiply whatever is in that bank by a factor of 12 and still stay with international banking rules. Now, of course, recently we found out that the largest banks had totally ignored this reserve requirement. Morgan and Citi and Bank America, they were all leveraged 50 to 1. You know, they were only supposed to be leveraged 10 to 1 at that point. Goldman Sachs was leveraged 333 to 1. Freddie and Fannie were leveraged 72 to 1. You know, that's why they've crashed so hard, and that's why they've needed this massive bailout money just to give the appearance that they're still solvent, even though they aren't. Well, in any case, the State Bank of North Dakota, because it has this massive infrastructure, imagine the cost of all the roads, all the bridges in a state. You know, it's money that's been invested by the taxpayers over 100 years or more. And this is worth a lot of money. And when you multiply that times a factor of 12, it's worth a lot of money. And so the bottom line is any state bank in the nation is better capitalized than any commercial bank in the world because of this massive infrastructure and the guaranteed income from tax receipts. So they immediately put their state, or at least the governmental portion of it, on an extremely firm foundation. They don't need to go to New York money center banks to float bonds. Not only does that save you the interest, but it saves the control. No longer do you have to go begging to New York, you know, to create a bond issue. You borrow it from your own state bank. This has worked very well in North Dakota. Once again, you can have all the theories you want, but nothing beats experience. North Dakota has, it was the state with the largest surplus last year. Virginia in the coming year is actually going to have a small surplus, and one of our local politicians was touting this and saying, oh, Virginia is the only state that has a balanced budget this year. And I wrote him back and said, you know, Virginia's surplus is $200 million. That's one-tenth of the North Dakota surplus, and Virginia has 12 times the population, so I wouldn't go tooting that horn too loud. So the Bank of North Dakota model will work for any state in this union. I know Ellen Brown in California has been working very hard trying to get interest in the state bank concept out there. It would do a world of immediate good for California. And I'm not thrilled with Jerry Brown in other ways, but I understand that Jerry Brown is behind this concept. So,
well, that would be wonderful, because as an educator in California, I certainly have noticed that that our debt situation is being leveraged to do a massive rollback of services for the populace, including education. So if indeed Jerry Brown is a backer of the state bank concept, then there might be some light at the end of the tunnel, and money might flow. Not only would money flow back to education, but that they couldn't use the debt to downsize and privatize education, which is the trend towards in California.
Right. Well, it would bring immediate relief. I mean, California is certainly a worst-case scenario, and I'm not sure exactly how quickly it will bring relief, but at least it would stave off any new private bond floating, private debt issuance. And there might be a way to roll over the existing debt, roll that right into the state bank so that you wouldn't have to be making pulling those payments out of the budget. It certainly has worked very well in North Dakota. North Dakota returned something like $300 million back to the state treasury. And this is for a small state of only 600,000, 700,000 people. They fund all college loans in the state. They've reduced property taxes. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing. And I think in the coming legislative session, which for most states begins in January, it certainly does in Virginia and Missouri. I was in Missouri. I was on the floor of the Missouri House, introduced on the floor of the Missouri House. And certainly legislation will be introduced in Missouri to this effect next year. It was initial legislation was introduced here in Virginia and promptly tabled because, unfortunately, it was introduced as a joint resolution, and so we couldn't resurrect it. But next year will be a different story, and you're going to see that. I know of 10 or 11 different states that are actively pursuing this state bank concept. Next year, it's going to come on everybody's radar screen. Suddenly, the Bank of North Dakota is going to be sung from a bunch of different locations.
Bill, what is to protect the Bank of North Dakota from the corruption that is involved in our banking system? Because, I mean, it doesn't matter what type of system we have if we continue to not make those corrupt individuals accountable.
Well, see, they were very, very smart in the way they designed the Bank of North Dakota, and that's they design it to replace any of the local commercial banking functions. See, when you float a bond issue, you don't go down to your local bank to float it. You go to the New York Money Center Bank. So who gets hurt in this is not your local bank. It's the New York banks. So the Bank of North Dakota was specifically designed to collaborate with the local bank community, and in fact, therefore, the local bank community loves them. I mean, they float them short-term loans when they get into trouble, stuff like that. They kind of act like a mini Federal Reserve, and so they've got the complete support of the local community, and thereby they're apparently able to totally bypass the federal system that involves so much corruption.
Well, that's a good question, and we probably should talk about the Goldman Sachs type of corruption. But before we do that, Bill, could you explain to people what fractional reserve lending is? You were throwing out some ratios. I think very few of us actually understand that. I've watched your movie so many times, I think I do, but I'd still like to hear your explanation for it.
I bet you can explain it better than I can. In any case, banks, incredibly, I mean, most people don't know this and don't believe it the first time they hear it, but it is true. When you charter a bank, let's say your initial capital is $1 million. As soon as the charter goes through, you can immediately lend out $9 million or now $12 million and charge interest on it. So, I mean, you're creating money totally out of thin air and getting the privilege of charging interest for it. So when you go down your bank and borrow money, you're not actually borrowing green pieces of paper called dollar bills. You're just borrowing little number entries in the bank's ledger sheet. And so it's totally fictitious money, and these guys get the privilege of charging interest for it. They try to hold it down to a dull roar by maintaining a certain fraction. In other words, if you have $1 million in the bank, you only get to loan out $12 million or whatever. But you know, as we've seen, these regulators are not exactly always on the ball for whatever reason. Call it corruption, call it just too much information, too many people violating the rules at the same time. But in any case, the fraction has been quite variable. And in fact, Mr. Obama himself, just a month ago, got on TV and said the fraction should be zero. In other words, banks should be able to unlimitedly create money and have the privilege of charging interest on it. Just a stunning, absolutely stunning thing that the president said.
Well, isn't that the best description of what our monetary system is? Isn't it a pyramid scheme?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that pyramid has now reached an apex which has never before been seen in human history, and that's complete debt saturation. There is so much saturation in this debt saturation in the system right now that people can't even absorb any more debt. So their backs are to the wall. That's why I can say with a surety that this system is going to go down. I might not term it as a collapse, but it will be a controlled collapse.
One of the other factors that I became aware of when I watched people working with money is there's a huge psychological factor that goes along with it, and that people put their value and worth into something, whether it's real or not. And part of the system to correct it would be to try to educate the people to the point how that is so tied into the system. Would you agree?
I guess I don't really understand the question.
Okay, I'm sorry. What I'm trying to say is that one of the things that I've observed with people, and I've watched a few of these pyramid schemes, and the psychological effect that takes place when people are involved in them, and yet watching the same type of system going on in our monetary system, and how they try to keep our psyche up with the system that they're manipulating, I would find that is be very important in educating people on how that is so pertinent to the problem.
One of the key tricks in order to maintain this pyramid scheme is they try to make it so complex that people just give up and go, oh, I don't understand. In fact, about 6-7 years ago, there was a great story in the New Yorker magazine, and one of the senators on the committee that was interviewing Alan Greenspan when he was first going up for chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. This is longer than 6 or 7 years, I forget. But in any case, was being interviewed in this New Yorker, famous New Yorker magazine piece, and he said, you know, Greenspan talked in such complex economic terms that we all figured he must know what he was doing, so we put him in. So, you know, this mystification process, you see it all the time, and that's what I constantly battle against. You know, fortunately, I'm not a real smart guy. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. So I'm just a reporter, essentially, that's turned filmmaker. And so it has to really be boiled down into simple terms, or I just can't get it. And that's turned out to be, you know, a real asset in this work, because their major modus operandi is to try to make things so complex that people won't understand, won't fight it, think that it's hopeless, and just go, well, I hope the government takes care of it because I can't figure it out.
Well just to kind of underscore that point, I can't remember exactly the Senate hearing where this occurred, but as I recall, Greenspan, after the financial collapse, after all his theories were proven wrong, he got up there and said, well, our models are wrong. Sorry. In other words, the economy is going down the toilet and we're losing trillions, and sorry, all our best models by our best economists proved to be wrong. So for all of these decades, this period of time, Congress was buffaloed into thinking these guys were geniuses, and then after the damage was done, then Greenspan just gets there and says, well, sorry, our models were wrong.
Right. Well, sorry about that. We just inflated the economy and made out like bandits on it. And now we're proclaiming ourselves to be too big to fail. So turn over $3 trillion of your national wealth to bail us out, or else we'll crash the economy even further. It's the same economic blackmail cycle that they've utilized time and time again throughout U.S. and world history. And hopefully we can break that cycle this time, because the results are going to be much more severe than ever before.
And yet Henry Paulson, I believe, has come, of course, Department of Treasury, head of the Treasury Department, who was, ushering in this TARP deal, and also former, CEO of Goldman Sachs, has come out with a book, something like How We Saved the Economy or something like that. So even as they're crashing the economy, they're trying to take credit for saving it.
Well, these guys are flim-flam men. That's just no ifs, ands, and buts as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they're just trying to get through the next election. You know, they're desperately trying to get through November without this economy crashing.
But when you look at countries like Argentina, where they, you know, they go in and they pick the bones clean, and then they go build them back up, and then they go back and do it again. And so we're fooling ourselves if we don't try to see through what they're doing and hold them accountable, so that we don't have to keep doing this over and over again.
Right. Well, they know quite well that people's history memory is very short, and their memory of history is very long. They know exactly what they're doing and how to do it. And education is our only shot. And if I could put in a plug for where people could get the movie.
Because, oh, please do.
It's www.secretofoz.com.
And that's for all of your movies?
No, just The Secret of Oz. The Money Masters has its own Money Masters site, which is easy to find on Google.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and say you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. My co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest is Bill Still, and who has produced the latest movie, The Secret of Oz.
Yeah, and in the movie, Bill, you feature a number of experts. One is, like you mentioned, Ellen Brown, who's written a book called The Web of Debt. Let's see, you also feature interviews with people about the Bank of North Dakota. I'm trying to remember some of the other individuals that you featured who were kind of economics experts. I guess these people would have to be called alternative economists. How would you describe people like Ellen Brown? They don't share the typical college education, economics education, do they?
No, well, Ellen's an attorney, so she's a well-educated woman. But also, we have Professor Michael Hudson in there, who is really one of the Gang of Eight economists who knows what's going on and is willing to speak out about it. But you have Byron Dale. I mean, these people are all people who are, with the exception of Michael Hudson, outside of the economics community. Why? Because it's well known within the economics academic community that the quickest way to derail a promising candidate from a 10-year track in the Department of Economics is for him to even breathe the term monetary reform. And that's just the way it is nationwide. And so it's self-selecting. Those who breathe the term monetary reform in this day and age just don't get tenure.
Okay, now I'm very interested in this angle since I've had a career in academics. Do you have some specific experience with this kind of thing? Do you know some cases of people who have tried to discuss these things and then been denied tenure?
No, I don't. It's just a popular saying. I've read it repeatedly. As I say, my brother is a tenured professor of economics at a major Midwestern college, and
mm-hmm.
it's just pretty much based on personal experience.
Yeah, and the perception then that your brother and you would have anyway is that that the banks in particular have had a very, very large impact on the kinds of materials and courses that are being taught throughout our entire university system. How would that, do you have a sense of how that plays out? Is it through the professional organizations? Is it through individuals? Is it through networks? I believe you that this is occurring, but it's something that I think most people would not have much sense of.
Well, it's a combination, you know, textbook manufacturers, the major professional associations. I don't have the names. However, I believe I did write about that in my first book, New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, and had these specific organizational names. But I don't have them on the tip of my aging brain at this point.
Okay. Going back to our monetary reform ideas, you talked about the state organizing things through state chartered banks. What would be the approach at the Fed level?
Well, at the Fed level, we need to. I think if you just eliminate the ability of nations to borrow, if you eliminate the national debt concept, that goes a long way. We need to take back the control of the money power into the as close to the voting electorate as you can get it, namely, ideally, the lower house of Congress. But there are also other people. Now, see, I'm not the technician. I just present other people's ideas because this is the specifics, since I'm not an economist, I just don't want to get outside of my depth. But basically, if you put it, you can create some separation between the elected politicians and the actual decision makers of how much money there should be in the system by creating something called a monetary authority. And this is also, there are folks in Britain who are working on the same idea for the UK. There's another, a Milton Friedman precursor by the name of Irving Fisher and Paul Douglas of the University of Chicago and Yale University back in 1939 wrote a wonderful paper called A Program for Monetary Reform, where they set up two ways of doing it. And one way was to create money based on a market basket of commodities. And I think that's just way too complicated. And the point is, I don't think you're going to maintain sufficient political pressure unless the average American can understand what's going on and support it through his politicians. I think you just sink back into this mystification thing. The easier way to do it is the way Milton Friedman told me was his favorite at the time when I was talking to him, and that's just base it on population. And that's, you put, you know, X amount of dollars in the kitty, in the American kitty, based on population, and then we all go and fight over it instead of having complex formulas where, you know, the rich bankers are always going to be able to maneuver and get a bigger share for themselves, et cetera, et cetera. So if you just say, okay, we're going to have $100,000 per capita in the system, and that's it. As the population goes up, then the government would spend more money, have some extra free money to spend in the circulation. And that way, that should pretty much control prices, or at least much better than it does today. And plus, it would be money created without debt, and so we wouldn't have any interest to pay. Do you know how much we're going to be paying in just interest on the national debt in a year or two? Over $1 trillion. I mean, I can remember the time when the total national budget finally went over $1 trillion. But, you know, now this is going to be a third of our national budget is going to be paid in interest primarily to bankers. This is outrageous. That's the total amount of your income tax receipts It's not going to the government. It's not going to fund old ladies' pensions. It's just going to bankers paying interest on the national debt.
One of the things that you bring out in the movie, of course, The Money Masters, is that the Constitution gives to Congress the authority to print money or to make coins and determine the value thereof, and that there were a number of wars and assassinations throughout our history in which European bankers were trying to wrest the power of money creation from the federal government. But in fact, under George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the government printed money that was not interest-bearing, that was debt-free, and this is how, at least according to the movie, America was able to win both the Revolutionary War and the Union was able to win the Civil War with the greenback dollars that were printed by the government. These were fiat currencies. There was no gold behind them. Just the goodwill and the influence of the federal government was behind them, and yet they worked perfectly well. And they were not debt-bearing currencies like our present. And the difference is, of course, the more money we have in circulation, the more debt we have. It's that simple, because the money is lent into existence.
Yeah.
So there is historical precedent for us having the government issue the currency. In fact, I think it was, I can't remember, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln said that printing the currencies was the government's most creative role.
Your most solemn responsibility. That's the greatest power of a sovereign nation. The thing that makes a sovereign nation sovereign is control of its money. And we absolutely, positively do not have that as a nation right now. We have control by bankers. And, you know, to show you the level of ignorance, even amongst politicians, even amongst economists that you see on TV, you see this every single day if you watch TV a lot. And as I work, I've always got the TV on. And that is, they'll say stuff like, well, what we need to do is to have some austerity and pay down the national debt. In fact, I think I saw President Obama say that just today. That's absolutely inane. All of our money is created out of debt. If you paid down the national debt, you would be extinguishing some of the national money. That's our problem right now, is we are in a deflationary cycle where money is exiting the system. If you enhanced that, that would just make it even worse. So that's not, you can't just pay down the national debt. Number one, it'll never happen. Number two, if it did, it would make things tremendously worse. You have to eliminate the national debt. Just eliminate it and go to a debt-free system, or else it won't work at all.
So are you saying something like a jubilee?
Well, that's a possibility. That's something that Professor Hudson has always favored. And in fact, for all practical purposes, that's what you have going on right now with these debt write-downs. You're having a partial jubilee. The banks are having to take less money. And so, you know, that the jubilee is a concept in the Bible. And, in fact, it actually predates the Bible by a long way. It was back in Samaria, maybe 2,000 years before the Bible, where it started, where every 50 years the Sumerians, in their wisdom, had discovered that debts would accumulate to such a point that civilization would collapse unless the debts were wiped off every 50 years. Now, there are some exceptions. I believe it was debts owed by foreign merchants or something like that were not wiped away. But debts in the general public. And so you can imagine, if you wanted to buy a mortgage, you know, buy a house and have a mortgage for it, you know, a couple years before the jubilee year, well, you wouldn't find very many takers. But, I mean, society would adjust to that. And I'm not advocating this as a system, because I don't understand the full implications of it. But in any case, we don't need to stiff people. All we need to do is return to a debt-free money system and just pay off the debt you know, whether it's right, wrong, whatever, whether the profits they derived were immoral and we shouldn't pay them, just for practical political purposes, pay them off with our new money. If they don't like that, just like I told them in Iceland, if the bankers don't like that, fine, then they don't get paid. If they want to get paid, they can get paid with our new debt-free money. And get them out of our hair and just never allow debt the United States to go into debt again.
That's probably the more practical solution, but I remember listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky who talked about the precedent in, I think, the Spanish-American War when the U.S., you know, took Cuba. The U.S. government proclaimed the debt that Cuba owed to the Spanish government to be odious debt, and it just eradicated the debt and said, you know, doesn't have to be paid because it's odious debt. And so that's, I suppose, that's the more heavy-handed approach. Yours is a little bit more benign, which is pay them off in money that is created by the government, and then no more borrowing from private bankers.
My goodness, you've just taught me something. I've never heard that. I've made a quick note, and I'll have to look into that and include it in my shtick here in the future. Odious debt, that's a great one.
Well, it certainly is odious debt. we have a world awash in odious debt, and of course, when you are the creditor, you're the banker, you are the IMF, you are the debt cops, you are the government of California, or whatever, you can impose draconian austerity measures on the people. And this is, I think, what we're seeing and what we're going to see increasingly. It's like a kid that racks up a huge debt on a credit card and can never pay it off. That kid is a debt slave for you know, decades after that.
And that's the way it's going to be for our children. I mean, there's going to be a lack of jobs. None of them are going to be able to find jobs. They're going to be wondering why. They're going to be wondering what happened. They're going to think, is it me? No, it's the new system. Get used to it until you get mad enough to change it.
You know, I have to wonder that this debt got to be so large that they don't even know how to handle it, and at the same time they're trying to monetize it with some sort of resource, and it has got to be such a huge task that they don't even know what, you know, the what's
going to come. Well, that's true. For the first time in world history, I think it's out of their control, and what Eric was talking about when he said that you know, our models don't work anymore. Well, I mean, that's exactly right. Their models were never any good in the first place. All it was a model of maximizing profit for the world's biggest banks, disguised as something academic. So, yeah.
So if we don't, you know, call them on it soon enough, they're going to have acquired the resources and commons and everything else. And so timing seems to be of importance here.
Yeah, you're right, and that's kind of depressing, but I don't know. I just have hope. I mean, if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't be out doing this.
I'm not saying it's hopeless. I'm just saying that, you know, the sooner we wake up to what's going on, the sooner we can do something about it.
Yep, America's still a rich country, and I think there's more to this than just a bunch of bankers trying to enrich themselves. I think it goes deeper than that. It's the people who want to really return to a system of serfdom and see the United States as being the biggest roadblock to a return to that system. We still have a lot of money. We still have a lot of wealth in this country. We still have a large middle class, and we can still do something about this.
And that's where, again, where it goes back to the system. It isn't just the monetary system in its own right. It's the whole system that goes through our education and many other aspects of our lives that controls us, so that it and allows those that are trying to keep control.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, Bill, would you be willing to venture into the topic that you explored in your book, The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, and relate what's going on with kind of our present world, with this long range objective of a one world government, a new world order. Would you be willing to go in that direction? I appreciate the fact that you've stuck with the economics of it and the basic outline of the problem and the solution. But I think that it is important to understand some of the longer-term goals of the ruling elite or the plutocracy that you discuss in your book, The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies.
Well, I'm not interested in talking about individuals. I think I see that as being a worthless endeavor at this point. So, you know, as long as we're talking in general terms, I think that's good. Basically, what we've got here is an attempt. The United States got out of control and deconsolidated power and set a framework for deconsolidation of power that's very dangerous to those who like the serfdom system. And so what they're trying to do is consolidate power at every level of government on the face of this planet. And that's why you see state legislatures up in arms, about a loss of state sovereignty. It's because the federal government is deliberately trying to consolidate all power unto itself. And in turn, the international governments are attempting to consolidate all power unto themselves. And, you know, this is nothing less than the biblical Armageddon scenario coming right down the pike.
Well, it is fascinating how much it does resemble the biblical Book of Revelations. I remember it wasn't too long ago that a conservative would stand up for states' rights. And now we've seen the neoconservatives backing more federalized power. So we've had actually a complete redefinition of the words liberal and conservative, so that they essentially don't mean what they used to. I guess they don't mean much at all anymore, do they?
Well, like, who are you talking about? What conservative would not back state sovereignty?
Well, the neoconservatives under George W. Bush, I mean, they were not backing state sovereignty at all. They were backing the increase of federal power.
Right, but we're past the Bush era, so now the only person I can really maybe think about on the horizon would be Newt Gingrich, would be of that ilk. Possibly Romney.
But who's to say that they wouldn't do the back and forth game of, you know, going from one extreme to the next, so they kind of just, you know, bat the ball back and forth. So it could rise up again.
Yeah, but, you know, the good thing is that all these state legislators, I mean, power has been spread out to a significant extent in this country, and it's by numerous state constitutions and even enshrined in our federal constitution. It's not that easy to break that up and reconsolidate power. We still have time to fix this.
Well, one of the things, I did an interview this morning with Daniel Estulin, who went to the Bilderberg meeting, and one of the things that he was stating that came out of that meeting is that they didn't accomplish their goals. So obviously the rest of the world is paying attention.
Right. You know, and that's what I always see. There are a lot of people who tend to bemoan the fact that everything is a conspiracy and they've got us under their thumb. And, you know, this is not the case. The history of this New World Order crowd has been a history of an amazing degree of failure. They've got all the money they want. They've got all the political connections they want. And yet they've been unable to succeed. Nation states love their sovereignty. People love their nations. And I think that's great. I'm a Chinese nationalist, a French nationalist, an American nationalist, an Icelandic nationalist. And you can see why if you look at it, you know, in the broad general sense. What's the most basic concept at the bedrock of our federal constitution? And that is the separation of powers concept. It's not mentioned, but that is it. And what does that mean? That means power is spread out to the maximum extent practical in this country. And, you know, on the international level, what is that separation of powers concept? It's the individual sovereignty of the nation state. And people intuitively understand that, even though they might not, people might not be articulating it. They understand that. They love their nations. They think it's important that their nation remains sovereign. And so these guys, no matter how hard they try, I mean, the League of Nations was a failure. The United Nations has been, for the most part, a failure. And so now what they're going to try to do is bankrupt the entire world and then bring it under their New World Order thumb.
Right, through debt, they can enforce the radical changes, and of course what we have is an enormous debt all over Europe, many countries essentially bankrupt.
And so, you know, that's all the more important why if we can get our foot in the door with Iceland and show these other countries that, hey, you know, there is another way to go. You don't have to do what the bankers tell you. Just tell them to go away. We're going to print up some new worthless pieces of paper called money, and we're going to pay you with it, whether you like it or not. If you don't like it, go away.
Don't you feel like the money that has disappeared, supposedly, or they don't seem to want to speak about where it went, isn't that going to turn around and come back and purchase are more than likely purchase our own commons and assets away from us?
It may well be, but, you know, I'm not at the level where I can tell you what happened to that money. It could have gone swept up into the derivative vortex, which, you know, who knows how big that is. I was shocked when people a year ago we were talking about it might be $500 trillion, and now it might be $1,000 trillion. Just nobody knows, and nobody's going to know for years and years and years to come how big that thing actually is. And so a couple trillion dollars is chump change in that world.
Again, but where I want to point the finger at least at the culprits that seem to stay in the limelight if we don't hold an accountability. They seem to kind of resurrect themselves, and that to me is as important as reforming our monetary system.
Well, the culprits are the people who proclaim that we can fix this by just continuing to charge debt on the national credit card. I say, no, that's wrong. We have to totally eliminate this whole system, not just reduce the level of charges. We have to eliminate the ability of nations to borrow. And anybody who opposes that, I say, is in the wrong camp.
It was Thomas Jefferson, I believe, who said he wished he could obtain another amendment which would forbid the government from borrowing.
Yeah, Jefferson was absolutely right on that, and I think he was the only one who said it quite that succinctly, and so more power to him.
You know, one of the things that I was really impressed with in your movie, The Money Masters, was the fact that so many of our major events, you know, were blamed on various other aspects, but when it really came down to it, most of the depressions and the wars and that were tied to the bankers.
Well, certainly all the depressions were. In fact, in the run-up, after the populists lost the election of 1896 with William Jennings Bryan, essentially the bankers then were free to make their move to consolidate their power, which ended up in 1913 with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. But, you know, still there was still plenty of populist sentiment around, and it took numerous, if you look at the period between 1896 and the actual passage in 1913, there were numerous mini booms and busts, which the bankers completely contrived for their own benefit, namely so that they could have the New York Times write, well, you know, because of all these booms and busts, we need somebody in there who can stabilize the currency. And, of course, that ended up being the Federal Reserve System. And, you know, it didn't take long before the fruits of this new Federal Reserve System came home to roost with the Depression of the 1930s.
Which Milton Friedman actually did agree was caused by the Fed, by the Federal Reserve. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that was Friedman's hypothesis, and in fact, the Fed admitted that it was true, finally, on the occasion of Friedman's 90th birthday, as reported on National Public Radio.
Right. As I recall, I know you don't want to talk about individuals, but Ben Bernanke was asked about that, and of course he's head of the Federal Reserve at the time, and I think he still is. He said, "It's true, we did it. We're sorry."
Yeah, we won't do it again. Promise. Just keep giving us the power.
Yeah, it was pretty glib response. We're sorry. Yeah, so the Fed has enormous power, and from what I understand, as a result of the last couple of years of financial crisis, the Fed has much, much, much more power now than before 2008. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we've given them more power. We've allowed them to consolidate power even further in a system where the very problem was they had too much power. So somehow we think that that's going to fix the problem. No, this problem is just going to get worse and worse and worse until people are literally rioting in the streets.
So one would think that perhaps that is the goal of the very small banking elite or individuals within the banking elite is actually to bring on chaos, perhaps to end the nation state and end the American experiment. And bring us towards a one-world feudalistic system. Would that be perhaps the implicit
goal? I'm sure that's
goal?
What's open, but I have confidence that America has untapped psychic strength, or whatever you want to call it, where we will not go down that road. We'll be able to somehow maneuver, and I just don't see that as happening. I don't see this whole notion of concentration camps and rioting in the streets, and that, I just don't see it. I don't know how we're going to get around it, but, you know, Americans love their freedom, and they love their country. The average American doesn't, in any case, and I think we're going to find a way around this. And, of course, the only way around this is true monetary reform somewhere in the neighborhood of what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, I have to kind of wonder if that's what they are after in their own right, and with the threat of all these other aspects looming over our head. And then in the meantime, as long as they incrementally move the system to where they want it to go, they will get it put in place and possibly not have to go through that as well.
Maybe so, but I don't think this American experiment in freedom is over yet. And I think we're going to, once we realize that that's really what this is all about and that is threatened. And I think you see that in the whole Tea Party movement and conservatives in general in this country. And really, it's not just conservatives. I mean, liberals are equally upset about this as far as the monetary reform aspect goes, and that's really hopeful. When you see folks from both sides getting on board, you know you're sitting on the truth.
Do you think the Asians are onto the game or part of it?
Well, certainly the most popular books in China today deal with this subject in one way or another.
What do you think about the local currencies that have popped up here and there? Do you see that as a positive development or not?
Well, it's a positive development in that it's a consciousness raiser, that, you know, it can be done, that, you know, money isn't something that has to be passed down from on high in the chambers of the Federal Reserve System, you know, that money is just a creation of the population. So it's a good consciousness-raising effort. I'm unsure whether it serves a good function other than that. It might serve more to distract people from from the true solution. However, I know that these complementary currency guys would just go nuts by me saying that, but I have to say I don't completely understand the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
Well, do you feel that in your travels that you have gained a lot of ground with your information?
Oh, yeah, unbelievably so, especially since the crash in 2008. But, I mean, it's just accelerating. In the last year, there's been so much progress. It's unbelievable. And the situation in Iceland is just something I couldn't have imagined would ever occur in my lifetime just a few years ago. I can't believe that I'm on shows like y'all's, you know, where now I can talk to an audience where I'm not continually besieged by gold bugs saying, you know, you speaketh heresy, you know, get off the radio. So, yeah, there's been great progress, and it's getting more and more interesting.
And do you think like a country like Greece, do they have any kind of direction that Iceland is going, or are they just another story?
Well, you know, I'm actually talking to some people in Greece, but you know, they're just more on the student level at this point. But who knows? Greece is an unusual situation because there's so much corruption there, and so there's not really a sufficient critical mass of people who understand the problem and are willing to go to bat for it because there's so much corruption.
Well, if I could just shift gears, and we'll probably come back to this point, but I did have a question, Bill, about your new movie, The Secret of Oz. In the movie, you rather honestly say or admit that that it's not known for sure whether the author of The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum, was encoding these economic messages, and that he didn't own up to it, but that many have taken these drawn these inferences because he was knowledgeable about these issues, that he was in fact a publisher of a newspaper, etc., and that this might have been his way to address these issues. What is your sense of that? Do you think it's a slam dunk that
that's really what he meant? Yeah, I think it's a slam dunk. I mean, his own son reported that Baum marched in more than one torchlight parade for William Jennings Bryan. Well, that's pretty committed. I interviewed a lady with the South Dakota Historical Society who wrote a book saying that, you know, Baum would never do that because he was much too Republican to support such a democratic, much less populist notion as this. But, you know, that's based on the writings in his newspaper, it was a local newspaper. It was in a Republican district. He had to write from a Republican slant if he wanted to get advertising. If you look at his life, you know, all his relatives, all of his later actions when he was living in Chicago showed that he supported the populist cause entirely. So I didn't even stick that woman in the film just because I found her to not be credible after investigating it.
Okay, so in as far as your research goes, this is a parable. It is about the economic situation, and it is pointing towards a solution. And that message got completely lost in the movie version of A Wizard of Oz, which we all grew up with and love. So for all of our lives, we missed the point. I guess that's the point of the story.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, Baum saw that the populists were losing with the loss of the 1896 election, and so he wrote The Wizard of Oz kind of in desperation. He saw that, you know, this whole concept, this issue, was sinking, and I see it as he wrote it as a flare to send up into the night of history, knowing that somewhere down the line, this debt money system was going to explode and people were going to start looking for answers and maybe somebody could figure it out. And it's also indicated by the next things that he wrote after The Wizard of Oz, because right at first he was not at all confident that The Wizard of Oz was going to work. And so he continued writing on other topics. He wrote a screenplay called The Octopus, which slammed the money powers. And so that just really puts the lie to this whole theory that Baum was a Republican and would never write on this topic. So, you know, he wrote The Wizard of Oz hoping that somebody in the future would notice it, and somehow or another I noticed it.
Well, it's fascinating that the groundwork has really been has been done, in the sense that everyone knows the story of The Wizard of Oz. We all grew up with it, we love it, but we didn't understand the hidden meaning of it. So to the extent that that people can start to understand what he was trying to get at, then maybe this thing could catch on pretty fast. That's your hope, I gather.
Yeah, well, you know, and you know, when I was a kid, you know, The Wizard of Oz used to be on. It was like an annual event. It would come
right.
on TV, what, like at Easter or something like that?
I can't remember, but it was annual, yes.
And but you know, after the first couple times, I would never watch it again because I just didn't like it, because I knew there was something going on behind that story and I couldn't figure it out. And I couldn't figure it out because the symbolism had been all mushed up when the movie version was made. But you could still see that there must be something behind this scarecrow and, you know, walking on the yellow brick road. There must be something behind that. I always thought intuitively, but I just couldn't understand it.
How much play is your new movie getting? Is this selling well?
Yep, it's doing very well right now, and doing very well internationally as well. I'm trying to work towards a Chinese translation version because I think that's going to really take off. But we're about to come out with a Swedish language version and an Icelandic version and a German version. So people are interested.
So do you have anything else kind of in the works down the road, or are you just focusing on this one?
No, I'm just focusing on this. It's a full-time job. I don't have a staff or anything. I'm just a one-man operation, so it's all I can do to do the publicity stuff and the fulfillment of orders and keep all that going. It's a lot of balls to keep in the air.
And go ahead and give your website again.
Sure. It's www.secretofoz.com.
And I suppose some of your older books and videos are also available on that website?
No, I've that's just focused on The Secret of Oz and discussions of that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, you had mentioned a book earlier that was the basis of The Money Masters. Is that still in print? Is that available somewhere?
It's not in print at my hands. There is... This is terrible. I can't tell people how to get my book.
You better work on that, Bill. Maybe get another printing or something.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's I don't really think that would be economically justifiable. And books like that just don't sell that well.
On the Horns of the Beast, the Federal Reserve, and the New World Order. Okay, so it's just not a moneymaker, and yet that had a lot of the information that you went ahead and used in the Money Masters video, which is 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Right. Okay. Yeah, in fact, the Money Masters, we calculated if we shot the entire book, it would be 12 hours.
Okay. Okay. You are fairly close to our Congress in Washington, D.C., I believe. Do you try to make inroads with some of those individuals or their staffers?
Well, yeah, my primary focus has been Ron Paul. I've been to his office. I've tried to get an appointment with him. I finally cornered him last October at the 35th anniversary of the Conservative Caucus, and told him, you know, I was starting to do a lot of publicity on the movie, and I was going to come out with another book on the topic, and you know, how about let's get together and see if we could reach some sort of a consensus rather than going at each other. And he just nodded and smiled politely and you know, my wife took our picture, and that was it. And then he faded back behind the screen that he set up around himself. So he's really not interested in. He staked his life on this gold-backed money thing, and he's not going to change at this point.
Do you suppose he has influential backers on that?
No, I think he's a good guy. I mean, he's the only guy in Congress right now who understands the problem to that depth, but he is just stuck on this return to gold that he gets from, you know, with his buddies, the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the whole Austrian economics gang and all that. But when you ask him, well, what's your plan for implementing this? You know, they don't have an answer. Because there is no, it can't work. It won't work. It's never worked. There's not a single nation, a single time in history that they can point to where it has worked. So they have no model to go to.
Now, is there one that where you're saying that there is one for what you're talking about, a model for it?
Yeah, we've implemented it. In fact, during the Revolutionary War, we used debt-free money, and it worked very well. And until the British sent over two counterfeiting ships, with which they parked in Boston Harbor, and they started counterfeiting continental currency. And that's now whenever you hear about a debt-free money in the United States, which lots of people call fiat money, and of course that's a misuse of the term fiat. Means declared by the government. So even gold money is fiat money if it's declared to be money by the government. So, but the gold bugs love to point to this era and say, look, continental currency was that, and there was terrible. There's that one Washington quote where it took a wagon load of paper money to pay for, to buy a wagon load of provisions. But that was just because the British were counterfeiting it. You know, once again, it doesn't matter what backs the money. All that matters is who controls the quantity. And if you control the quantity correctly, it works every time. It worked in England for 750 years. That's what built the British Empire, was debt-free money called tally sticks. They were just simple sticks of wood. I went to the Bank of England Museum for the film and interviewed the head of the Bank of England Museum. He brought out tally sticks. It's the only time tally sticks have ever been recorded on film. So there's a lot of history in the movie, and I recommend it highly.
Yeah, I certainly recommend the Money Masters. I've tried to show it to my students, but at 3 hours and 20 minutes, I have to show pieces of it. But it's very educational, a tremendous amount of history in there, and it certainly changes your outlook on American history to watch that movie. It's not what we learn in the textbooks. It's a different interpretation. Have you been attacked, challenged, vilified for that movie? And if so, who's been attacking?
Well, yeah, there's just one major attacker, and that's G. Edward Griffin. He posted a website, you know, telling people why I was wrong and how he thinks I'm probably well-intentioned, but I'm just dead wrong and blah 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 blah. So he's been the only attacker.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. We have had him on the radio show, too, so it's interesting to get the different viewpoints. Basically, you and he agree on the history of the Federal Reserve, the conspiracy of the Federal Reserve, but the lessons you learn from the history are opposite, in the sense that he wants to return to a gold standard, and you say stay away from that.
Well, that's why Griffin's history begins just shortly before the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. He doesn't go back, you know, another decade to the struggle in 1896 with the election of William Jennings Bryan. Why? It would throw the lie to his solution, because the gold money boys won out. I mean, the famous speech that William Jennings Bryan gave on the floor of the nominating convention was, the Cross of Gold speech is still regarded as the most important political oration made at a political convention. And the Cross of Gold speech didn't say gold is good. It said gold is bad, and don't put this cross of gold around the neck of the common citizens of the country.
And so does that, what do you feel about doing commodities with backing monetary? Is that something you wouldn't want to recommend either?
No, it's no good, especially in this day of electronic trading. I mean, people say, well, how about silver, because it's more ubiquitous than gold. And yeah, there's more of it. It would be slightly more difficult to control, but if you remember back in the mid-70s, two small players in the big world of big league finance, the Hunt brothers, were able to corner the silver market to the point where they had to change the exchange rules in order to break them, or else they would have completely cornered world silver. That's when silver spiked from like $20 an ounce to $50 an ounce before they finally broke them. So, you know, and that was 35 years ago. You know, now we have high frequency trading, and there's no way, as this bill moved through Congress to go to commodity backed money, that the rich guys club of the world wouldn't correctly position themselves to own all of the commodities upon which the money was about to be backed.
Right. I agree.
Of course, one of the interesting things that comes up in your movie, The Money Masters, is that under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 30s, during the Depression, he passes a law requiring American citizens to turn in their gold, which was then collected in Fort Knox, and that somewhere during the 60s, 70s, 50s, perhaps, this gold seems to have disappeared, and there have been no good audits or no audits at all. The speculation is that it is now back in European hands. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And still, you see, on the big economic shows, you'll see the host of these shows get up and say, well, the U.S. government still is the largest owner of world gold, so if we return to a gold-backed money, that would be great for us. Well, I'm sorry, but the U.S. government owns zero gold, despite the fact that they carry a lot of it on their books. And, you know, if this was not the case, the government could make me look absolutely stupid in any given day by just throwing open the doors and showing all the gold. They can't do it. They're required to have an annual physical audit of gold reserves in Fort Knox. Annual meaning every year, and yet one has not been done since 1957. So we have the biggest collection of gold ever assembled in the history of the world. The U.S. government says it's still there, and yet they will not throw open the doors to auditors and allow them to count how much gold is there. I found that highly suspicious.
And, of course, we can surmise that that gold changed hands from the U.S. government to various European banks in response to our national debt, wouldn't you say?
Well, just in response to out-and-out thievery was what it was. They sold it off for 30-some dollars an ounce, and then as soon as the gold was gone, the price started shooting up, and it's been going up ever since.
So the U.S. government, you think, just kind of sold it on the QT for a relatively low price, and then somehow or another this stuff was carted out of the country?
Well, no, it was not really on the QT. I mean, it was at the time it was well known. They did it to try to maintain gold prices through the London Gold Pool. But what people just don't realize is that the entire hoard was sold out of Fort Knox, despite the fact that the federal government still holds some gigantic amount. I'm sorry, I don't remember the amount right now, and I should remember, but I don't, on its books, and it's just not there. It's a lie.
So then it goes to show that we've got a lie starting at that level, then we've certainly got a lot of lies floating around out there.
There's a lot of lies floating around out there, and you know, what we do about all that, I don't know. I think let's just let's just move forward with the correct solution, and I think that's about all people will be able to handle.
Well, why don't we kind of bring this to a conclusion here of where you want to go and how, if there's anything that we haven't brought up to maybe cover here in the last few minutes.
No, I think 2 hours of talking is pretty much depletes my ability to talk about on the subject. We need to return. The main thing we need to do is eliminate the government's ability to borrow. That solves almost all the problems. We need to return the money power to the hands of Congress, preferably to instill as a constitutional amendment that there's only going to be X amount of money in the system. That's going to vary only with population. If that were made a constitutional amendment and the government was disallowed from ever borrowing money again, I think that would pretty much fix our problem. It would fix it pretty quickly, too. And once the rest of the world saw that America had finally, once again, regained its sovereignty and freedom, I think investment money would absolutely flow into the system like never before.
Well, again, I want to thank you for staying up so late and informing our audience on your work, and I hope that we can make some inroads with your information.
Well, thank you very much. I'll just give the website again. It's www.secretofoz.com.
And any closing comments, Eric?
No. Well, just to thank Bill very much for joining us and especially for staying up. I know it's 2 hours later back in D.C., so that's really, really impressive. And I would just reiterate his two movies are both very informative and I think give us the information that we need. And of course, they are The Money Masters, 1995, and then very recently The Secret of Oz. And The Money Masters, I think, in particular, gives us a long-term look at the history of money. And this is something that most of us take for granted. We don't think about. I'm speaking for myself. I never thought about it that much. The Money Masters helped educate me, so I would love to see that thing seen by everybody. And then The Secret of Oz brings home the solution. So certainly, thank you for your work, Bill, and for joining us. And look forward to having this interview posted on Melody's websites as a resource for people who can then go and share it with others.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, and good night.
Okay, good night.